Just to clarify, I'm leaving the staff of CVM, but I'm going back onto the board. They give me the title of vice president, so I've said to everyone, you can call me Mr. President. I'm very comfortable with that at the moment. I'm very at ease with it. So what I'm going to do, I've got masses of stuff that I can talk about when it comes to church, men, gospel, how we communicate evangelistically to men, and then how we actually get them on the path of discipleship. I've got masses of stuff, and after 10 years of just focusing on this issue now, and I've got an hour in the first session. I know that some of you are going to stay back to do some more stuff. So I'm actually going to do this in a very frustrating way. I'm going to just start presenting my stuff, and then when I run out of time, I'm going to stop. So if I don't reach the end of the point I'm trying to make, you'll either have to come back after lunch or be forever frustrated or relieved that you're going to escape, because I think that's the only way I can do it. Because also what I like to do when I'm talking with leaders as opposed to blokes in men's groups, what I like to do is try and get some kind of interaction going as well. So I'm all up for debate, argument, dissension, punch-ups, anything really to get the conversation going. As you see, I come from Romford and I lift weights, so I can take a lot of you. We're fine. So I want to get that conversation going, because we're talking about men here, and all men are experts on everything, aren't they? Yeah, men are, they're opinionated, we're experts, you're leaders, so you're men who are leaders, so that makes it even worse. So I do want to get the dialogue going. As you can imagine, being in our current culture, leading a ministry internationally which focuses on one gender, men, does mean that you polarise people. I, as you heard, come from a Brethren background. I have a reformed position theologically. That means that your head is above the parapet on many issues when it comes to gender, when it comes to leadership, when it comes to church. But even just focusing on men can cause a problem. And I do have a number of friends out there, and they are genuinely friends, who are feminists and would define themselves as feminist Christians. And I just want to put this to bed straight away. They would disagree with me fundamentally on the fact we even need a single gender approach ministry. They would say, at its most extreme, that we are exactly the same apart from our genitals. That it's only culture that makes us different. I think that's absolutely rubbish. I think men are completely different to women. I think our brains are wired differently. It's not just our bodies that change, but the way we process information. All of that is different, I think. Now, I know that there's a broad spectrum of masculinity. So I am a little bit more thought through than it might appear at some point today, because I'm going to make broad, sweeping statements that frustrate some of you, because my hope is that it'll get us thinking, but I've only got limited time, haven't I? So I can't go into all the different subtle nuances of masculinity. I understand that some men like tapestry, and that's okay. I understand that there are some men who like that, and there are some men who like Formula One and blowing things up. I get that. I get that we're not all the same, but there is one thing that is true, and that is we have testosterone, and we have 6 times more testosterone than women. Most women. This means that we need to have a distinct approach. So I can't just say that to my feminist friends. I have to have research. You know, when we're going out into the newspapers or the media or on radio, we have to have research. So I'm going to show you a couple of videos today. I want you to hear a couple of other voices as well. I really want to just get thinking about this. I don't need you just to listen to me. But I'm going to show you a video now, which I think massively demonstrates, this is serious scientific research, massively demonstrates the acute differences between men and women, okay? Now, in Gloucestershire, there is a cheese rolling competition. You heard of this, haven't you? You just chase the cheese down the hill. Completely pointless. But I'm going to show you, it's British, we're eccentric, aren't we? I'm going to show you a clip of video, firstly, of women chasing cheese down the hill. And then I'll show you the acute difference when men do it. So firstly, here's the women. Okay, that's the women. That's women chasing cheese down the hill. Now, I'm not seeking to paint caricatures here, but let's have a look at the men. And that right there is a testosterone factor, which is about the limit of our extensive scientific, highly expensive research that you're going to get today. But we do want to look at some statistics, which just fleshed this out a little bit. Tier Fund survey in 2007, I think they interviewed 10,000 people. All of this stuff I can give you. There's lots of information on our website. It's the cvm.org.uk. We don't charge for any of this research or staff or teaching we put together. It's all available for you online. 50% fewer men than women in church, according to the 2007 statistic. 33 million Christians, apparently, in the UK. I don't know if you believe that or not. But that's still because if you chop the top of your finger off and you go to A&E and they ask you what religion you are, because they're doing some census survey, people still say I'm CV or I'm Catholic. So officially there's 33 million Christians in the UK. 6 million they're saying are attending church on a regular basis. That could be, I think when I ask for regular, it's defined as once a month. And 2.1 million of those are men, according to a 2011 census. So again, quite interesting there. 70 odd million people in the UK, give or take the odd million. So not doing brilliantly well when it comes to male church attendance in overall church attendance figures or in terms of penetrating the UK with the gospel. In fact, I think in the last serious census, 250,000 people said that they were Jedi Knights. And it wasn't even on the survey. This shows you've got a lot of witty people in the UK, doesn't it? Let's look at this one. This was another one from 2007, different to the 2011 one. They were saying that 7.6 million people attend church regularly. 2.6 million of these are men. One man to every two women ratio in the church, which again I think is just very, very interesting. I'm actually now, I've just founded with a number of other people a new sort of coalition of ministries. We're doing this thing called... it's called Engage, but the subplot is making Christian marriage possible for all. Because actually, Christian marriage isn't now possible for all Christians. Because there aren't enough men in the church. So it's got to such a high degree now that the separation between men and women, that you can have these gorgeous, intelligent, you know, women in church that are looking for lovely husbands and they can't find them. So, you know, Christian marriage is now not possible for everyone. And that's a sad state of affairs, isn't it? Which means we really need to step up our evangelism. And that has all kinds of spin-off impacts on family life and all sorts of things. So there's serious stuff here. But this one I find quite interesting as well. 3% of the UK adult population is upper class, but the church UK adult population is 22% upper class. Now that says that we are really good at reaching posh people. We're not very good at reaching your ordinary, typical British bloke. I was just saying in a conversation during coffee, I've just planted my fifth church. We're just into week five, having all sorts of good fun doing that. We're in Chesterfield, where there is a population of over 100,000 people. If you include all the mining villages around Chesterfield, there's 250,000 people, but there's less than 1,000 people in evangelical churches in Chesterfield. Now, so out of an immediate population of 100,000, there's 800 people in evangelical churches. I mean, that is massively unreached, isn't it? I mean, if you add in the liberal churches that are there, you're still only going to get to about 1,500, 1,600 people. It's a massively unreached population group. And when you look at the churches in Chesterfield, they would be 60 to 70% female. Which just raises really interesting points, questions for us. And this would also be true where I live. And this, we seem to see this all over the place. 10% of people in well-off areas go to church, but 5.9% of people in deprived areas go to church. And I find that absolutely fascinating. So your average British bloke, and I'm going to paint a caricature now, your average British bloke does not do church. Fact. And the problem we have is this. So I'm gonna gear this presentation in a minute. I've done a couple other bits. Deliberately, a caricature of British man. Drinks warm beer. Reads The Sun. That is the most popular paper out there still. Watches the football. Supports West Ham because he's a bit switched on. Comes from a working class background. May have 3 to 5 GCSEs or O-levels, has an average IQ of 100 to 120. He's a standard British guy, doesn't read that much. Goes down the pub with his mates, has an opinion on everything. You know, quantum mechanics, you know, the Higgs boson particle. Give him a couple of pints and he'll have an expert opinion on everything, and even religion, but he doesn't do church. So this is the issue that I face. This bloke, let's call him Dave, typical Dave. Apologies to anyone here who's called Dave, but you are now typical Dave. Typical Dave is here on the scale of belief. Doesn't do church, doesn't do religion unless he's had a pint. He's an ordinary bloke. He'll dialogue after a beer because it's a laugh. He might think he goes to church because he's done a wedding and a funeral. And he might have gone to a christening. You know what happens, a dress up, put a suit on and go down the pub and have a few pints and a roast beef meal. You know, and he's done church, he's ticked a box. He's here. Now, you might say I'm overly painting a caricature, but my family will come from Dagenham, and that is exactly what they do. That's what all my mates do where I grew up. That's you know, I'm one of the few people from my school who went on to do A-levels and get a degree, a couple of degrees, and got gentrified by process of education and clawing our way up. But most of my mates left school with a handful of O-levels and either became millionaires in the city, which is so frustrating, or they're plumbers, you know. So that, and also millionaires. But that's them, you know. That's Dave. And then you got Dave Mark II over here. He's this stand. And Dave Mark II is he's you. You know, he goes to his small group we heard about earlier. He reads the Bible. He might not have done what our first speaker did, which was treasure the first Bible he even got and studied it before he became a believer. Because the first Bible I ever got from the Gideons, I smoked. So, because it was made of Rizzlers. So a slight difference there. I was just reflecting on that while you were speaking. But, you know, grace, we both got there in the end, didn't we? So that's fine. But he's here. So he does his small group. He does his Bible study. He does Sunday school. He's a delightful man and all of that stuff. That's here. Most churches try to interact with Dave as if he's here on a scale. That's the problem. And he ain't. That's not where he is. Church planters know that. He's way over there somewhere. So most of our theological approach to evangelism, our practice of evangelism, the things we talk about, the things we think they're excited about, they're just not. They're just not. And they're not looking at churches and making spiritual responses. They're making sociological responses to what they see. But they're just not interested. Like, if whether you do Christianity Explored or Alpha, that is like here on the scale, actually, of belief. Why? Because you've got to sit down and have a hot pot or a shepherd's pie with a load of people you've never met before and talk about your feelings and what you think about things after listening to Nikki Gumbel or Rico. Dave will not do that. You know, and he might be wrestling with stuff in his life that he's not prepared to talk about. To get someone to this point, you've got to be massively along the scale. So we need to think, particularly when we look at evangelism, what's this bloke thinking about here? And many pastors that I speak to don't even pop into their local pub. I don't know what's going on inside it. Never seen the inside of a book is. But we've got to really understand the culture that's over here. So we've got that question here of how do we progress people over to here. I'm going to look at that as soon as I can once I've got through some other stuff. Because that's a massive question, how we do that process. That may be this afternoon. But what I want to think about first, because we're going to work back, because that was the title of the first talk I got, is when this bloke, Dave, gets to here, and this means that he might have just be hovering around Christianity Explored, he may be on his third one, because blokes are stubborn. It takes an average 5 years for a man to come to faith and point the first year in the gospel in the UK. He may now be attending church, and it is a mysterious place. So I'm now thinking for this session, what I want to look at is, how do we create a vibrant attractional model, which I'm just going to put some teasers out in a minute, but also start to interact with Dave here in a way that grips and excites him in his faith and helps him for the long term. Now, old methods do work. when they're done appropriately. And I still believe in the power of the gospel spoken out to see lives radically transformed. So I don't want you to think that I'm not thinking that when I start talking about process evangelism and friendship and all of that kind of stuff, some of which we know very well, but it's going to have a bloke slant on it. But I did want you to listen to this video before we start digging into church culture, because I just think this is very powerful. You're aware of the magicians Penn and Teller? Well, this to me is, this illustrates two things. I'm going to show you an interview with one of them who is a devout atheist, a committed atheist, and one of the champions of atheism and a sort of a global spokesman for atheism and anti-gospel, really. And two things will come out of this little video, but I just want you to watch something that he says. It's a couple of minutes.
Show. And at the end of the show, as I mentioned before, we go out and we talk to folks and, you know, sign an occasional autograph and shake hands and so on. And there was one guy waiting over to the side in the what I call the hover position after I was all done. Big guy, probably about my age. Big guy. And he had been the guy who has picks the joke during our psychic comedian section of the show. So we had the props from that in his hand, because we'd give those away. He had the joke book and the envelope and the paper and stuff. If you haven't seen the live show, that's not worth explaining. We had props from the show that we'd give him the night before. He wasn't the guy that night. And he walked over to me and he said, I was here last night at the show, and I saw the show and I liked it. I wanted, and he was very complimentary about my use of language and complimentary about, you know, honesty and stuff. He said nice stuff. No reason to go into it. He said nice stuff. And then he said, I brought this for you. And he handed me a Gideon Pocket Edition. I thought it was from the New Testament, but I also thought it was Psalms from the New Testament, right? Psalms from the New, just part of the New Testament. Not this big, this thick, you know. He said, I wrote in the front of it, and I wanted you to have this. I'm kind of proselytizing. And then he said, I'm a businessman. I'm sane, I'm not crazy. And he looked me right in the eye and did all of this. And it was really wonderful. I believe he knew that I was an atheist. But he was not defensive. And he looked me right in the eyes. And he was truly complimentary. It wasn't in any way, it didn't seem like empty flattery. He was really kind and nice and sane and looked me in the eyes and talked to me. And then gave me this Bible. And I've always said, you know, that I don't respect people who don't proselytize. I don't respect that at all. If you believe that there's a heaven and hell and people could be going to hell or not getting eternal life or whatever, and you think that, well, it's not really worth telling them this because it would make it socially awkward. And atheists who think that people should proselytize, just leave me alone, keep your religion to yourself. How much do you have to hate somebody to not proselytize? How much do you have to hate somebody to believe that everlasting life is possible and not tell them that? I mean, if I believed, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that a truck was coming at you and you didn't believe it, if that truck was bearing down on you, there's a certain point where I tackle you. And this is more important than that. And I've always thought that, and I've written about that, I've thought of it conceptually. But this guy was a really good guy. He was polite and honest and sane and he cared enough about me to proselytize and give me a Bible, which had written in it a little note to me, not very personal, but just, you know, like to show and so on. And then like five phone numbers for him and an email address if I wanted to get in touch. Now, I know there's no God, and one polite person living his life right doesn't change that. But I'll tell you, he was a very, very, very good man. And that's really important. And with that kind of goodness, it's okay to have that deep of a disagreement. I still think that religion does a lot of bad stuff, but man, that was a good man who gave me that book. That's all I wanted to say.
Don't you think that's fascinating? An absolutely fascinating video. For a couple of reasons. I mean, I think he's had a stone put in his shoe. And I think C.S. Lewis first coined that phrase. And I think that's my approach to reaching men. That I just want to put a stone in their shoe. I'm not always going for the conversion kill line. You know, I want them to walk away from any interaction they have with me with a limp. But I, you know, sort of, like a bomb in their brain that's about to go off. What on earth has happened here? So much of what I do about church discipleship for men, creating church for men, is about putting stones in their shoes, much of our evangelistic approach. I think that happened there. The reason, there's a couple of reasons why I showed that today. Firstly, that's a typical male response, actually. I've never had opposition from a non-Christian bloke when I've communicated the gospel. I've never had opposition from non-Christians about my evangelistic ministry. Ever. The only opposition I've ever had has come from the church. I've never, ever had it from a non-Christian. For the most part, I've found that when we're culturally appropriate in our response to the gospel and we communicate it in a straightforward way and we don't pull a punch, I'm a complete advocate for this, we either see lives transformed or people walking over limp, and it's never broken a friendship once. Men appreciate a direct approach. I'm absolutely persuaded of that. So I just wanted to show that because I've seen that kind of response from people many, many times. The second thing I think is fascinating is that we see a lot of this ill-informed, like lack of knowledge. He's a leading voice for the atheist movement. He thinks that Psalms is in the New Testament. Don't you think that's fascinating? So a lot of what, the other reason I showed that, a lot of what we have to do is deconstruct people's we've got to help people unlearn. We've got to help people become very good at unlearning. We tend to focus on helping people learn stuff. We want to put loads of truth into them. But I find in evangelism, particularly in our culture at the moment, and with men, you've got to get very good at helping people unlearn. Because a lot of preconceived ideas, a lot of bad knowledge, incorrect stuff in people's heads, we've got to get out of them. And that's a process. I think that's why it's taken increasing amounts of time for people to come to Christ now, which we'll talk about after lunch. So one method, Bible in a bloke's hand, sane, few phone numbers, email, take no chances. It's five phone numbers, it's an email. I love that. Look at this one. This is a bit different. Who is that? It's not Gandalf. I'll give you a clue. Anyone an idea who that is? William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army. But I won't dwell on this, but look how fascinating this is. Have you noticed what he's standing in? He's standing in a Ford Model B. In 1904, Ford had 12 Ford Model Bs in the world. And people had never seen anything like it. William Booth, heart for the poor, justice, on the streets, dealing with the homeless. Massive heart for the poor. Bought four. He bought a quarter of the global stock of Ford Model Bs for the equivalent of £250,000. Do you know why he did that? For one reason. He knew that he needed an attractional model. And we are unashamed about that too. Use all means to get an audience to communicate the gospel. He knew that if he did a convoy of Ford Model Bs and people had never seen it, it's an engine, it's a horse with an engine. People had never seen anything like it before. Working class blokes never get close to anything like that. So he knew that if he did a convoy around the country, his famous tour he did, from one end of the country to the other, he would draw a crowd of hundreds and hundreds of men. Then he'd be able to preach the gospel to them. And that's him, look, standing in the back looking like a wizard next to a racing driver. And he was standing in the back when crowds and crowds of guys, and then preached the truth. And we would advocate similar approaches. So like our men's festival, we use cars and stuff and devices and bands and comedians. We've got over 2,000 guys coming to an event in June next year. It's solidly evangelistic. This is guys breaking bread outside the tent because finally we had a nice weekend. Loads of those men there would have come to Christ for the first time at that weekend. So absolute straight down the line preaching the gospel, but you use stuff that actually draws a crowd. We have to do that. But then the big challenge is, how do we retain them? I'll talk about that further later. So let's ask not a trick question. It's just a question. Please don't think I'm trying to trick you when I do this. I need to emphasize something here. I am a church leader. I've been in church leadership for 20 years. I'm pastoring a church at the moment I've planted. Before doing that, I was a Sunday school teacher. I'm not a church deconstructionist at all. I don't attack church. I'm not undermining church. You get a lot of people doing my kind of work end up feeling a bit chippy about the church. I don't in any way. But I am prepared to point out the elephant in the room, or at least try and find them, or ask difficult questions. So that, you know, not all of them I'll agree with. But I'm prepared to ask the questions in order to get somewhere and move us a little bit along. At least ask the difficult questions so that we might be able to win some men. So here's two lists, left and right hand list. Which one of those two lists would you say is more indicative of gospel culture in your church? The right or the left? Who would go for the left hand list? One person.
Bit of both.
What would you be emphasising more? Right or left? Who would go for the right hand list as a majority one?
Aspirational.
Okay. I was very intrigued to ask this question of you guys today because you would all be here from the sort of Reformed tradition, and I do speak to a broad spectrum of churches, so I was very interested to see what you guys would say. In my interactions with more conservative churches would tend to attract more men, typically, but mostly educated, graduate class, which is another question, but you do tend to attract more men. So I was very interested to see your response. This came from a controversial book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And the right-hand list was women, and the left-hand list is men. Now that raises an interesting question for us. You may disagree with my statement earlier when I said people make a sociological response before they make a spiritual one. It's plain simple, this. Put a grumpy person on the door, over 70 years old, and your church is communicating itself for grumpy people aged over 70. Put someone in skinny jeans on the door looking like a hipster, and you're communicating your churches for hipsters. People make a sociological response before they make a spiritual response. Men, even more so, actually. Now, the gospel, just to clarify my understanding here, does emphasize the right-hand list in many ways. It's about community, loving each other, sharing. I mean, look at Acts 2 and all that kind of stuff. It's all there. However, there is also a strong strand in Scripture, I would believe, not just because I'm reading it through a male lens for the last decade, but there is a strong strand in Scripture of the left-hand list. You can pick it out of Acts as well. As much as you could do the right-hand list in Acts, you can do the left-hand list in a redeemed sense. Look at Nehemiah. In chapter 1, he's on his knees praying, so we got that bit, when he hears that the walls are broken down, but he's very quickly, he's drawing an action plan, goes in through the valley gate, comes out through the dung gate. By chapter 3, he's got a strategy. But up to chapter 6, it's all hands on decks. You know, perfume makers rebuilding the wall, daughters next to sons, and all kinds of people, all hands on deck. He gets a threat, and he counters a threat. He gets opposition, and he counters the opposition. He has a spear in one hand and a shovel in the other hand, we read. But he's got a thoughtful strategy, and you see in the book of Nehemiah, power, competency, achievement, success, accomplishments, targets, and goals. It's all there. It's a brilliant management book, the book of Nehemiah, and you see it in other places as well. But here's the problem for us. You may agree or disagree with my assessment here, but your average bloke called Dave, who is now hovering in here, he likes to win. He's a man. He's competitive. He plays his daughter at Monopoly, who's aged eight, and he wants to grind her into the ground to get Mayfair. And if he loses, he pretends that he did it on purpose. He plays swing ball with his son, and he wants to win. He wants to be the expert at everything. He's a competitive person. He has testosterone coursing through his veins. Of course, he's not yet a follower of Jesus Christ, who will happily lose at Monopoly, won't you, when you're playing your young daughter or playing golf. He is man. He's Dave, and he has this strand. Dave likes to win, so Dave typically will put himself in an environment where he feels that he can succeed. What happens to Dave when he enters an environment, he's been intrigued by the gospel, he's gripped by it, and then he comes into an environment where he feels he's set up to fail? He just spins to the edge. This is why you see blokes in churches who could be CEOs of global corporations not doing much more than handing out a notice sheet at the door, or not using their vast skills and talents to do anything more in a church, because they don't feel it's a place where they can succeed. Now, you may disagree with me, but this is a story that's been played out and out across the country in massive numbers, and that's why we're seeing a hemorrhage of men. 49% of men left the UK church under the age of 30 in the last 20 years before you even think about winning new blokes back. So clearly something's going wrong somewhere. So this is a problem for us. Church culture is communicating a female set of values, but men are living in this male set of values. Now, I think the women are stealing here slightly, because they are gospel values. They're not just female values. But there needs to be some understanding of some redemptive use of left-hand list qualities. I don't know if anyone wants to come back at me at that, but on that point, but I think that's absolutely crucial for us to begin to wrestle with. So this would be not an exhaustive list, but you know, this could be male culture. It could be a bit of a caricature in places, but it's generally true. It's not true of all church leaders, by the way. Church leaders don't tend to be on the masculine spectrum often. I'm not saying you're all very girly, but don't tend to be, broadly speaking, the kind of, because of our training methods and the kind of people we're recruiting into ministry, and what we demand of people who are training for ministry, doesn't tend to attract a bloke who was once a builder. So, and you know, that is another issue we might have to wrestle with in the years ahead, I think. So this is not the broad spectrum of masculinity. It's one narrow view of, you know, the average British bloke. But doers are not receivers. We like to do stuff and not sit passively. You guys have been trained over many years to sit and listen to lectures and talks. Most men haven't. I have a habit of always having non-Christian guys that I'm working with, trying to communicate the gospel to. I took one of them before we planted a church to a local Baptist church of mine, and I got a fascinating response. He said, "Why were there three speakers?" I said, "Who were the three speakers?" He said, "You had someone come up and give a talk about money." He said, "Someone came up and did a talk about some sort of order things that were happening." He said, "And someone gave a lecture. Why didn't the person who's doing the lecture do all the other talks as well?" I said, "There wasn't a lecture." He said, "There was a lecture." I said, "Well, you mean a sermon?" But he thought it was a lecture. He was really bored, because he was just talking about stuff that doesn't go on in his life. And this is another issue, isn't it? We read the Bible, we look at Numbers 7, and sit in our studies and get absolutely fascinated and overawed by this great new truth that we've discovered. But the average bloke just comes out of work and thinks, "Well, that's not really interesting, so I think I'm going to be made redundant next Wednesday. Well, I've got to make someone redundant on Wednesday." And this great new spiritual truth that we discovered doesn't seem to get rooted into their lives. Bear in mind, I'm talking about Dave here. Just goes over the top of his head. And they don't like to sit passively. They want to do stuff. They place their worth in their work. One of the first things that people say to you, when you meet a bloke, what's one of the first things he says? "What do you do for a living?" Very quickly gets to that part of the conversation. Men are like pack animals. They scratch and sniff each other for the hierarchy, you know. And particularly if they drive a nice car, they'll soon let you know it's a Merc or a Jag. They don't seem to mention a Ford Focus. It's interesting that. They're not very verbal. Most men don't do small talk. Most Christian leaders who are men actually find small talk very difficult. I'm actually by nature quite shy. You won't believe that, because I'm standing at the front giving a presentation. But actually, I quite like sitting at the back, and I don't like being the centre of attention. And I, you know, I've had to train myself to make small talk conversation. It's just not what I do. You know, when I was a school governor, once I'd done the cheese and wine reception, and I'd said, hello, isn't the weather terrible, and look at what West Ham's done this week. I'm kind of stuffed to know what to talk about next. What do I talk about? I just don't want to talk about my feelings, you know, not sure I've got any. Yeah, so it's that kind of thing going on. We're not very verbal. We tend to forge bonds in adversity when we overcome something together. Men are quite boring, actually. It actually fascinates me. We talk about the same things over and over and over again. When you... We need to create, you know, evangelism, we'll talk about this later, but more moments and memories, because men talk about moments and memories endlessly. I'll talk more about that later. But when we overcome something together, we really talk about it a lot. We take time to trust. We appreciate opinions. You reserve the right to disagree fundamentally with everything someone said, but men tend to gravitate to someone who at least has got an opinion and quite forthright about their opinions. Love them or hate them, we do like opinion makers, you know, and formers. Men look for leadership from about age 5, they reckon. Boys are looking for heroes, which is something we need to be massively aware of in our churches, kind of role models we're putting in front of men. That's why we need more men doing Sunday school. That's why I did Sunday school. We need more men standing up teaching our kids. Kids, boys particularly, looking for role models from about age 5, looking for leadership. Men are very objective, they're not very subjective. What I mean by that is... my daughter was randomly assaulted, what day are we now, last week, and the police had to be involved and all kinds of stuff. And my wife, her instinctive response is, how is everyone feeling? How is my daughter feeling? You know, and every morning, is she safe going out of the house? And because it was a gang thing and blah, blah, blah. I'm thinking, I want to know that my daughter's safe. Process, are the bail conditions on this girl going to be enforced at the school, like logic sequence, you know, uncooked spaghetti. My brain is uncooked spaghetti. Logic, rigid, you know, just everything in its compartment. My wife's brain is cooked spaghetti. So everything's jumbled up and it's very emotive and subjective. And I'm not saying that in a horrible way, because actually I wish that I could make some of the emotional connections that she makes. But you know what it's like. I'll be late home from work, and I just think, I'm late home from work, I will say sorry, it will all be good. My wife thinks, you are late home from work, and this brings back a memory from 1989, when that happened once before, and also the car's broken down, and I'm feeling that even more acutely now than before, and you didn't wash the windows when you said you were going to do that. And it all spirals into this sort of cooked spaghetti entanglement of emotional, like, hell, you know. And I think, how did we get there? I just was late from work, you know. Because I'm objective. I just think logically through things. And we do things side by side and shoulder to shoulder. Church isn't always like that. So the big challenge for me, if I can get this thing working, is actually putting the right tools in the hands of guys so that we can actually get the job done. So let's just move on to elephant in the room. First one for me is that Jesus is a man. You might think, well, you all know that. But you wouldn't believe that when you go into your average church. When you think about the songs we sing, the activities that we promote, the people we pray for, the activities that are spread throughout the whole life of church, you would not think that. Let's do this a bit differently because of time. Okay, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm not. Let's be really real and honest. I'd be interested to see your responses. I think you come from, you know, a pretty focused church tradition and approach, culture. Who do you pray for on Sundays?
The sick.
The sick. Not the dead, because that's another tradition. The sick.
Queen and government.
Government, politicians, leaders, the Queen. Yeah, those in authority. Sorry?
Missionaries.
Church leaders.
Suffering world.
Okay. So these are the immediate responses. I'll call a halt there. So the sick, those in authority, suffering world, missionaries, etc. Cool. Do you have a prayer sheet that goes in your bulletins, any of you? No prayer calendar budget? They would be the kind of people that are on your... the elderly, the sick, the nearly dead... that kind of stuff. And what about what professions do we pray for? We had church leaders mentioned. Are any other professions prayed for?
Teachers.
Police. Okay. That's interesting. Anyone else? Caring professions? Carers?
Doctors.
Interesting. Anyone pray regularly for van drivers at all? Train drivers, builders, plumbers, mechanics? Sometimes.
We might do if they're
in. Very good. Very interesting. So who is the church for? People make a sociological response before they make a spiritual response. Who have you just told me your churches are for? You told me the church is for those in caring professions. Why? Because caring professions are perceived to be more kingdom. Unless we want, you know, the banker's money for some big activity the church is doing. So the church prays for caring professions because their caring professions are more kingdom. We pray for the sick because that's a right-hand list activity. We pray for missionaries because they're more somehow spiritual. The problem we then face is that you are now sending out a massive signal to Dave that this is place is not for him. Massive signal. All the sociological markers are saying this place is for my wife and my children, and I'm valued if I'm in a caring profession or if I'm in some position of church leadership. That's fascinating, isn't it? Now, I'm not saying that to have a go. These are just my observations after many years of trying to influence church culture to see and try and understand just in one aspect of church life, because church is a spectrum of activities through the week, isn't it? Why are we not engaging with men? So I'm just going to hop forward a little bit here to try and get some stuff done before the break. You could argue that church is a passive environment. We talked about it because you just come in and you sit still and you're told stuff. It's very verbal. There's worship often, particularly in the charismatic tradition. If you've got time, we'll look at that later. Is incredibly romanticised. I now don't use the term feminization of church. The reason I don't do that is because it's so loaded. You end up picking fights that are off the issue. So I've learned to say romanticisation of the church and worship culture. I'm going to try and look at that after lunch. Most activities are measured around women and youth, children, the sick and pastoral values, and language of intimacy is very high. The way commitment is measured needs to be looked at, which we'll do after lunch. We also need to think about our gospel language, which is something we'll do after lunch because we haven't got time to do that now. But there are some very simple things that you can do. Let's draw up a list here. We'll get past worship culture because I haven't got time. But some of it's terrible. Just to say this for those of you who are not going to be here after lunch. One of the massive problems that we have in worship culture is we have 20-somethings writing worship songs that want to sound like Coldplay and they are not theologians. They're literally putting words together that rhyme well and create an emotional sociological response. I'm sorry if that's very cruel to young and upcoming worship leaders, but I think we learn our theology through what we sing, you know, very often. And because it's put to music, we remember them often more than sermons. And we're learning some very bad theology from worship, aren't we? So let's think about this. Working back, I would destroy mercilessly missionary boards. You know what I mean by missionary boards? It's the world map where you have a picture of someone's face with a bit of string going to the country where they're at, unless you're in Chelsea and you've got a light-up LED, which you press a button and it all lights up. I would get rid of them or change the way that you do it. Now, I know that we don't want missionaries to be forgotten, but there is a problem with this approach. It says that if you're an accountant in Haywards Heath, you are not quite as important as an accountant for math in Africa somewhere. But you could be a really godly accountant striving to keep businesses afloat, employing staff, trying to be a good boss, but never get prayed for. You could be a van driver who goes on a mission trip and you get prayed for, but be a van driver for Tesco and never get prayed for. We over-spiritualize some aspects of mission work over others. When actually, I believe, if you want to see a grassroots movement of men who are compelled by the gospel, they all need to see themselves on mission, don't they? So just as a tip, I'm messing this up a bit because of time, because I'm trying to put 2 days worth of stuff into an hour. Here's a tip, just to be very practical. Let's say you've got someone in your church who's a young man, and he's just become the apprentice bus mechanic at Hayward's Heath Depot. I don't even know if there is one at Hayward's Heath, but let's make it up. He's got a new job. I don't know what you do to celebrate that or empower him for mission. I don't know what approach you take. But this is what I would do now after learning from all the mistakes that I made over the years. I'd get him out of the front. And I'd celebrate in front of the whole church the fact that he's just got his first job as an apprentice bus mechanic at Hayward's Heath Depot. And I'd call the elders of the church out and we'd lay hands on him. And I'd ordain him. I would. I'd say, we ordain you as God's missionary in Hayward's Heath Bus Depot. You're God's man. You're an employee of Jesus Christ first and foremost. You are there to be salt and light in that depot. You're going to make a difference. God has sent you out. You are saying you're just as valuable as someone working in the depot for MAF in Tanzania. You're a man on mission. And I'd lay hands on him in front of everyone and I'd pray for him. That's what I do now. And he'd feel like he'd feel amazing. And then I'd call him out of the congregation a month, 2 months later, and I'd say, give us some stories from the front line. What can we pray for? And I wouldn't just pray for caring professions now. I'd be regularly looking at who's on our prayer list and all kinds of stuff. Here's an interesting observation for you. When I was living in Bath, I tend to move every 5 years. As people find out more about me, you sort of move on, don't you? So when I was living in Bath, my first week at a local Baptist church, someone I found out was a church secretary said to me, who are you and what do you do? I said, well, my name is Carl and I'm an evangelist, actually. That's what I do. And he went, he said, what's your ministry? And blah, blah, blah. So I told him. 3 weeks later, we're still going back there. The prayer calendar comes out as a sheet. Who you pray for on every day of the month. I was on it. So I went over to him. I said, mate, that's amazing. I'm not even committed to joining the church yet. He said, well, I've checked you out online. He said, you have a very busy schedule. He said, how many miles are you driving a year? I said, well, about 30,000, 25,000. He said, you're away from home a lot? I said, yeah, a huge amount, actually. He said, well, that's a lot of strain on the family. He said, you know, your work you're doing is hugely important. We need to be praying for you. I said, what do you do? He said, I'm a sales director for a thermoplastics company. I said, travel a lot? He said, yeah, yeah. So how many miles are you doing your car? About 25,000, 30,000. I said, oh, are you away from home a lot? He said, yeah, a huge amount. I said, why aren't you on the prayer sheet? He said, well, it's not important work, is it? That's kind of sad, don't you think? That was a wake-up moment for me. That was one of my, you know, epiphanies. My goodness me, that all these men out there, and they're just feeling this place is not for them. So, you know, overseas missionary boards. Why would I get rid of bad coffee and weak tea? Just because I hate bad coffee and weak tea, really. But actually, there's a really interesting point here. People make a sociological response before they make a spiritual response. Starbucks knew that. When they were growing a business, they gave everyone really great coffee. So I give people a really good welcome. Our new church has a reputation. As you walk through the doors, you smell great coffee and you get a brilliant welcome. And you know what? People are turning up earlier and earlier and earlier, and they're leaving later and later and later. Because actually there's this beautiful moment where people start being community together around great coffee and snacks. You may say that's shallow, but I'm trying to take blokes from here to here. And these are the kind of things that people are looking for. You say, well, the gospel changes people's lives. Yes, but let's give ourselves a fighting chance at actually getting in front of some people with the gospel first, shall we? Let's do that. Messy notice boards, that's because more men tend to be OCD than women. You might think, well, my bedroom's messy and I'm not very tidy at home. But actually, men like clean lines. They really do. Look at businesses that are seeking to attract men, like a car dealer. Look at the way it's lit. Look at the way it's set up. I mean, they have a particular approach because they know what it takes to attract men. Here's a tip for you. This is amazing. You're going to think, why did you put bad toilets on there? Well, this is absolutely fascinating. You're going to think, this is not gospel ministry, Carl. No, no. Give yourself a fighting chance at getting the gospel in front of people. Do you know how many times you need to communicate the gospel to a man before he comes to faith on average? 30 times. 30 times. Hey, I'm a Pentecostal minister. I believe in the power of the Holy Spirit today to radically transform lives. I think you can tell someone about Jesus, and the power of the Holy Spirit can convict that person, and they can come to Christ on the point of first hearing the gospel. But the average is 30 times over 5 years. Give yourself a fighting chance at getting in front of these people repeatedly. Why bad toilets? My car dealer friend is a Christian. He's a very godly man. He runs a Lexus, Skoda and Mazda dealership up in the north. Very, very successful business. He argued at board level not to open on a Sunday. Internationally, argued at board level. Doesn't have a sign on his dealership saying shut. It says at home with our families on Sunday. He got it signed off at board level. It's his way of being a witness. He's an incredible leader, and he has incredible countercultural style of management. He's extremely generous. And yet, when I went into his toilet, came out, he was standing outside. And he said to me, "What do you think of my toilets?" I said, "Very nice." He said, "Do you like the aftershaves?" I said, "I did like those." "Hand cream?" I said, "Oh, that's not a particular use of hand cream. I think a man's skin should look lizard-like, personally. particularly into grooming." And I said, "Nice." He said, "Do you like the Dyson air blades?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "The tiling and everything, the way it all lit up." I said, "Yeah, it's really good, Mark, really good." He said, "I spend 4 to 5 times per square foot more on my toilets than any other part of my dealership." I said, "Why on earth do you do that?" He said, "Because all the research has shown that the deal is lost by the condition of the back areas that no one sees. Until they go there, you know. You go to the back areas, the toilets, and they're scummy, and it says, you don't care." He said, "And men will sign that, or will do that deal, or not do that deal, and how they think they're going to be treated." He said, "All the research shows that." And that's fascinating. I think that was fascinating. So people read my list and they think, "You're just such a shallow, unbiblical person." No. I'm trying to create a fighting chance to keep getting these guys to come back. So when we were looking for a premises for our church, we chose the best facility that we could find. It was just clean, nice, not over the top, but just made people feel good about being there. Think about your church toilets. And if they are scummy, I'd advise you to spend some money on them as soon as possible. And if you start mentioning people's workplace and praying for them, then they might actually give you some money to help you to do them up. So all these things do connect, don't they? Why do I ban banners? Because no one sees them anywhere in the world apart from the church. Apologies to our hosts who have put banners up today, but they just are strange to most men. They don't get it. If you have children's posters up, it says this is for children. If you have banners up, it says this is for people who like making banners. They're just, you know, put a TV up. Put some 42-inch plasmas up and put interesting images on them. You could even put pictures of banners on a 42-inch plasma screen and it'll be okay. Banners, however, are weird, as are pastel colours and old toilets. A few things here. Just before we break, I'm going to take 5 minutes. Breaking into small groups to share on a Sunday morning is place you on a hiding to nothing. Men do not want to break into small groups unless it's a rugby scrum, and they don't like sharing how they feel. I've got an engineering degree. One of my degrees is engineering. I don't do small talk, but give me an engineering problem back in the day and I'd animatedly talk about it endlessly and row about it. Take the problem away, it's like you turn a switch off. I've got nothing to talk about. Saying to each other, trying to be radical in your church, build community, and say, "Let's turn around and talk about how our week's gone," is a bad thing for men. Turn around and say hi to someone is okay, obviously. You know, but breaking into small groups to share intimate feelings, not good. Stroking is really not good either. By this I mean walking into church and someone hugs you and starts rubbing your back. If your welcome team do that, eliminate them from the welcome team or put them into a training process very quickly. Men also don't like their space invaded. For instance, Tim, if I walk up to you now this closely, that is really weird. And it makes you feel very unnerved. And I don't like it either. And I'm having to overcome feelings of feeling weird myself. Men are like repelling magnets. We like getting close to each other until we can feel the body heat of the other person. And then we really don't like it. So this is actually very true. Think about the way you put your chairs out, if you can. Blokes like a bit more space. They don't like feeling hemmed in. Look at me, I'm built like a fridge. I lift weights. I just become wider and wider and wider. I sit in the average church and I can feel my skin touching other people's skin. I don't like it. Dave doesn't like it. You need to give people space. The way we do prayer, if you're in a church that does prayer ministry, you may or may not be, but we just get too close to people sometimes in the way we do that. We'll talk about that later. If you're in a church that does use the gift of prophecy today, you may or not be. There's language we need to think about there as well. So I'm going to finish with this. The two statements here. To me, if you create a church that emphasises the need to reach men and male culture more than women, you'll actually end up with a unisex church of an even split of men and women. I'd put everything you do through a male filter. I haven't had time to talk about worship. We'll do that after lunch. We're going to look at strategies for actually reaching Dave over here. I haven't had time to do all of that, but I would say emphasise a male church. Put your worship culture, your teaching methods, who you pray for, everything through a male filter. And the women will love it too. I've genuinely found that. Women will love the stuff that you do in order to reach men. I would not just have sermons. I do believe in preaching. But I would also split the genders up and I'd do some interactive teaching. I'd talk about issues. I've always believed in preaching and preaching through a book systematically. But if I was doing that in the morning, I'd create forums to talk about life in the evening, or vice versa, because these guys just want practical tips. People need to know how to navigate life well. The problem is we don't want to become moral reinforcement and life coaches like some traditions, because that you just lose the gospel. But we do need some form where men can interact and actually say something. So we need dialogue and not just monologue. And I would say as well that just to finish now on this one, we need movement evangelism, not needs-based evangelism. We need to think about our gospel language. We've gone wrong somewhere in the way we communicate the gospel. So assume now that we've done the fundamentals. Jesus is the Son of God, lived, died, rose again, died for our sins, saved by grace. You've done that. We tend to end with a punchline that goes something like this. And if you give your life to Christ, he will meet your needs. That worry you have about your health, this financial issue or your family, the communication is, come to Christ, he meets your needs. Now, that's kind of true, but it's kind of wrong. And it attracts needy people, which is good, because Jesus died for people who perceive that they're needy. But it alienates men. Because men think they're all sufficient, all capable, and don't need a crutch. Now, let's assume they're now seeing their need of Christ. They don't need their needs emphasised even more. You want their spiritual rebirth, their spiritual DNA of being born again, to be a call to action. So how about a gospel message that does something like this, once you've explained the fundamentals? Give your life to Christ and he will take you to the wire. And it will hurt you. And it will cost you. And it will hit your wallet and your time and your commitments. All the priorities of your life will change. And anything good that you see in you actually came from him. And anything good you see in me is only because of him. One that is far greater than me. Of myself, I have nothing. And God will use you to fix up this broken world. And he will make you the kind of man you know you ought to be. And more. Do you want in? And it will cost you. And so the spiritual rebirth of that man is now action and service and servanthood and making a difference. Oh, and by the way, Jesus Christ might meet your needs along the way as well. But actually, that's not what you're calling people to. You're calling people to a life of sacrifice. That deeply appeals to a male spirit. You want to get men out for a men's breakfast? Don't make it 8 o'clock. Make it 5 in the morning. And I bet you get more people. Bet you get more people. But also, I think that's the wrong time of week to do men's breakfast, but that's something for next week. After lunch. So let's stop there. I think that's enough. I'm going to do loads more after lunch for those five people that now want to stay for more. Who am I over to? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Carl. So, whatever you do this afternoon, cancel it and stay here for more from Carl. I'm sure you want to hear more. David Sprouse, would you just come up and talk about SEMS and the quick survey we're doing while I swap over the computer?